State Senator Bob Duff, who is also the Senate Majority Leader in Hartford, representing Norwalk and Darien, joins us right now. He's running for re-election as an incumbent with the endorsement of the Democratic Party. Bob Duff, hello, Senator Duff. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Lisa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. So we've been talking a lot about the Queen's funeral. Did you ever get to meet Queen Elizabeth, Senator Duff?
No, she never asked. She never asked for an audience with me.
I know.
At all.
Well,
but I did watch a little bit of it this morning. It seemed very sad, but very majestic at the same time.
That's the word, majestic. For Her Majesty, it was definitely a majestic send-off, or it is a majestic send-off, for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll tell you the truth. It's just dawning on me that she's gone. I've been involved mentally, you know, at a remove to some extent since she passed. But I really think she's going to be missed, like really missed on the world stage. I do.
I think so, because she was just, it's just one of those things where it's just so steady. Mm-hmm. And she's been around for over 70 years as queen.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just a lot of times it's just a lot of continuity that when she was there, she was always there. And it just, I think everybody always kind of viewed that as comforting.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she's not there anymore. And, you know, King Charles is, even though he's known, he's still an unknown because he's now, now the monarch. And so it just, it's tough. And I would think also, you know, it was probably, if she had died maybe when she was 50 or 40 or, you know, it might have been a little different, but she really, it is really like losing a grandmother.
Correct.
Because you see her, her smile, she was a grandmother, she was a great-grandmother.
Yeah.
And I think for any of us who've had, you know, grandmothers, and I think losing a grandparent is one of the toughest things ever. And because they're always so special in your lives. And so losing her at, you know, the age of 96 is like really like losing a grandmother. It's like a piece of your family in a way. You just can relate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what is made a little bit harder for folks.
Yeah, I think so, too. And particularly because of the fact that she purposely was a blank slate upon which people could put their own impressions. That was part of her genius.
Yeah.
That you could believe that you had something in common with her, or that she was like your grandmother, because she never really betrayed what she actually thought about anything, which is enormous self-control. I know, Senator Duff, there's no way that I could have occupied that role. Not that way. No way. No way.
I know.
I mean, that's tough. That's tough.
I have people tend to know what I'm thinking by what's on my face.
Yeah,
so,
me too.
I don't know. Must be the Mediterranean in us. I'm not sure, but it's you always, you know, you do. You know, if for her to always kind of have that, you know, that you can guess, you can, you know, everybody can speculate what they think of what she's thinking. You know, for probably for like you and me, we're like, oh no, they're happy, they're not happy, they're really not happy with that person.
Right.
You know.
Right. So Senator Duff, tell me, you're in the middle of election season right now. Let me ask you, what is on the minds of your constituents when you go around and shake hands and ask for their vote? What are they telling you?
Well, they say a lot of things. First and foremost, I think they're happy with the way the state of Connecticut is going right now. You know, we endured a long time where we had to make some very difficult decisions on budgets and taxes and spending and employees and you know, lots of different aspects to try and get the budget kind of in a place where we didn't go from surplus to massive surpluses to massive deficits to massive surpluses and, you know, pay down those pensions that we've been paying down and all that. And I, you know, I think people see Connecticut now as a place that is long-term, of steady growth, that has a future, that, you know, has its finances under control, which is good. Secondly, I think, and so people want to, they see a place where their kids can stay, and they see a good economy, and they see opportunities, not only for them, but for their families. Number two, I think that people see that the governor and legislators and legislative leaders like myself have done our best and our very best at trying to manage through a pandemic where, you know, we're building the plane as we're flying it, basically, and that we had a steady hand. We opened our schools. We relaxed any kind of mandates that were out there as fast as we could, but we did it in mind of keeping people safe at the same time. And, you know, so I think that's good. And I think that we're also making good investments in our communities. And, you know, in Norwalk, I've brought back over $300 million over the last 2 years to help one of the fastest growing cities in the state of Connecticut. So I feel very good about all those things. And on their mind is other things like climate change and a woman's right to choose, gun safety, you know, making sure that Connecticut stays in a place that shares the values that a lot of us share, especially as it comes down to women's reproductive health, gun safety, climate change, all those things that that people really value here in the state of Connecticut.
We're chatting with State Senator Bob Duff, 203-333-9422. He's not only the state senator of a district that represents Norwalk and part of Darien, but also he is the Senate Majority Leader. I noticed that tonight is a meeting of the East Norwalk Association. They call themselves ENA. And they are concerned about, on September 21st, an approval for the changes to Norwalk's industrial zones that's up on the P&Z chart, as well as on October 6th, the approval of a 77-unit residential mixed-use development right at One Cemetery Street affecting Mill Pond. So where do you stand with respect to these changes to the neighborhoods in Norwalk?
Well, I'll speak globally. I don't intend to get involved in local planning and zoning issues. I got a full enough plate as it is without being the expert in local planning and zoning issues in Norwalk or Darien, because it's once you get involved in one of those, you get involved in all of those, and it's impossible. That's why we have a planning and zoning commission and a public process there as well. I will say globally that, you know, Norwalk is growing. A lot of people want to move here, and so we've got to change with the times. We also got to do that responsibly. And so there's got to be ways in which we can we can build, we can grow, because you can't attract businesses. You can't grow jobs if you don't stay with the times. And this is not the Norwalk of the 1950s. This is Norwalk of 2022. So with that, you got to find places where you do grow and you do grow responsibly, where you have transit oriented development. So if that means that you're building in an area such as around the East Norwalk area, but not down through the beach area, or you build around the South Norwalk area, but you keep it around the train station just like in East Norwalk, or you do some infill, you know, around Glover Avenue, which is literally in between a highway and a million square feet of office space. You know, those are areas where you've got to look at, you know, where you can grow the tax base, and how you can, you know, grow jobs and grow the economy. But that doesn't mean you have an unfettered hand to do whatever you want and every other place. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is growth in Wall Street area. We're seeing growth in South Norwalk. We're seeing growth in East Norwalk. You know, Cranberry, Silver Mine, West Norwalk tends to be, and Row 8 tends to be places that, you know, has some growth, but is not growing at the rate of the center of the city.
Well, the Glover Avenue thing is basically a brand new city emerging from nothing. I mean, that's going to be a new city.
That is a large development, absolutely.
Yeah,
yep.
It's huge.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
Senator Duff, but, you know, you say that you don't get involved in local zoning, and I can appreciate that you don't want to be opining on every application. But globally, as a matter of state policy, you have had a very big influence and impact over Hartford, believing that to some extent it should have a role in preempting local zoning decisions. And where do you stand with respect to that for the next legislative session?
Well, where I stand on all that is my position has been pretty consistent in the sense that every community has responsibility for affordable housing. We have a housing crisis in this state. We have a transportation crisis in this state, and they both feed off each other. Plus, you know, for decades, we've heard Republicans say that Connecticut is not growing. We're losing population. Well, one of the reasons why that was a fact then, it's not true now from our latest census, and it's not true over the last few years, is because of the fact that there has been younger people have left because there has not been accessible housing for them. Seniors left, some for tax reasons, some for the fact that there hasn't been housing for them. And the burden has fallen completely on the cities without having communities around us, around the suburban communities around us, take any kind of responsibility of housing or affordable housing or a diverse housing stock. You know, diverse housing stock is great for every single community. So I think that that is the way that we need to go, and especially around the train stations. You have people who want to move into various communities, and my feeling is this, is that if a community has a Dunkin' Donuts, if they have a CVS, if they have, they have schools where teachers teach, they have firefighters and police officers, if you have all those things in your town, you should have housing that that people who work for those in those communities, whether it's at the Dunkin' Donuts or whether it's a police officer or a firefighter or a teacher, they should be able to afford to live in that community as well. And so I think that every one of our communities has an obligation to build housing, whether it's for people who are kids who are just out of college, whether it's for people who are just trying to start families, whether it's for senior citizens who want to downsize but still stay in their community. Every single community has an obligation to do that, not just the cities.
Yes, but I understand that, Senator Duff. But you realize the current 830G statute, actually, after 40 years, this moratorium that various entities are having to comply with, that after 40 years, it goes back to the developer. It's sort of like a freebie, free market unit. So why is
so
that
I've got,
a
so I've
good
got you.
Solution?
This is the same conversation we had last time, Lisa. So I've got you saying, on one hand, it goes back to the developer because they can do that. And on the other hand, you'll say 8-30G doesn't work. So it's one or the other. I mean, you guys can't have both arguments. Cause I know where you are on this. I know you don't like 8-30G, and I know you don't like what you perceive as Hartford having some sort of hand in zoning, which, by the way, most other states do, and most other state governments do, or county governments do, but we don't have counties here. You cannot keep these communities the same as they are and expect Connecticut to grow. And every community, whether it's Westport or Wilton or some other town on the shoreline or towns around Hartford, every community needs to be able to do affordable housing and housing, again, a diverse housing stock. And so I don't know what to say on that, because this is how you grow the economy. And people complain about traffic on I-95. That's because people have to keep moving further and further away to get to their job. So, you know, I don't understand how, if somebody says, well, we need to have this service here in our community, but the people who work there can't afford to live there either. Just to me, that just doesn't square.
Okay, Senator Duff. You know what? It's a long, involved conversation with, I think, a lot of complex and important goals at play at the same time. I don't think it boils down to, maybe it doesn't even boil down to a simplistic conversation on the radio. Maybe it's something you and I should sit down and have a cup of coffee about. Because I with all due respect, I think you might be oversimplifying my approach to it, but that's okay. That's all right.
If people think that nothing has changed on housing or the 8-30G is so terrible, why doesn't every community then come up with their own housing plan and actually implement something? Because they don't want to.
A lot of them are, right? 830J.
No, they're not. No, they're not. They're really not. And they're really not building anything. And they fight every single thing. And again, it falls back on the cities to do everything, which is why the property taxes are higher in Norwalk and Stamford and other communities in Bridgeport. Because we carry the burden of the social services and affordable housing and every other thing. The towns around us can have lower mill rates. And they don't have the social services that they have to provide because they leave it up to the cities, and they don't have to worry about it. So, yet at the same time, tell me where communities around in the suburbs are building affordable housing at the rate that they need to build in order to satisfy the housing crisis that we're in, to grow jobs and grow the economy. Give me one town.
I think Westport, my town, is doing a pretty good job.
Really?
Yeah. I think if you want to speak to our P&Z director, I think she's really proud of the job that Westport is doing. In fact, she submitted a plan that I think is getting all kinds of attention because it's, I think it's called 830J, right? Not 830G. It's the 830J plans that these towns are required to submit. And I spoke with her over the weekend, and she was pretty proud of the plan. So I'm not saying every town up and down is doing its level best, but there might be some examples of towns that are trying.
Okay.
Anyway, Senator Bob Duff, I'm very happy to speak with you. Anything else you want to tell us and tell your community on the campaign trail before November for the election?
No, just that everybody seems to be thinking that Connecticut's moving in the right direction. And, you know, they are glad that our bond rating has been raised. They're glad that we have budget surpluses. They're glad that we're paying down our pension debt, that we have actuarially paid down our pensions over the last, 12 years. They're glad that, you know, Connecticut is you know, has a volatility cap, that, you know, it has forced savings. We have a revenue cap. So we've been, and we have, you know, two agreements with state employees that are literally saving billions of dollars a year. We don't have pensions. We have a pension 401k hybrid for state employees, which actually has turned out to be a little bit of a tough thing because of the fact that in this job market, it's a little tougher to hire state employees now. Because a lot of folks are going in the private sector. But you know, we have the Democrats, and this is a lot of these things have all been Democratic initiatives that we've done. And we're the ones who've been very fiscally conservative. We've been very fiscally prudent, and we have worked hard to write our balance sheet.
We have one call. Somebody holding to wants to ask you a question or a comment. Anthony from Westport, you're on the air with State Senator Bob Duff. Hi.
Good morning, Lisa. Hi. Hey, Bob. It was good to see you Saturday at my old neighborhood's block party, which you come to every year. And I was glad to be back there too. I moved to Westport, but I'm calling because I'm all for affordable housing, believe me. But what concerns me is these little cities. Let me say a couple of things first. The little cities that seem to be in these plans, they're all in little cities. And number two, I read that some of this affordable housing, of course, is only a few apartments at times in a big building. And they're not even guaranteed forever to be affordable. So I have the feeling some of this is getting through under slightly not correct pretenses.
That it's not affordable?
Well, they're building big places with a few affordable things in them. Like there'll be a small percentage, but they build these monstrosities, these little plans for little cities like in Saugatuck and Norwalk.
Yep.
It just seems that to me it's more of a money-making thing than it is a real actual consideration for affordable housing, which could be built in the right locations in the right manner and permanently.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing is that, you know, in Norwalk we did a choice neighborhoods that had that replaced Washington Village, which was, you know, was probably mostly low-income housing. It was flooded. It was decrepit. It had been, you know, way past its life of being useful any longer for any families, and built three phases of housing. It was called Choice Neighborhoods. Now, Choice Neighborhoods was an initiative under President Obama, and it has a market rate, it has affordable, and it has low income. And frankly, people said, "Oh, nobody's gonna." Live in those market rate housing because they don't want to live in, you know, some type of affordable housing building. As a matter of fact, those went first. Those are down in Sono. And then it was affordable and then low-income housing in there. And everybody's living in one building. And they're beautiful. And what I said at the beginning when we did the groundbreaking, I said, this will be a game changer for the entire neighborhood. This will help to spur other development. And guess what? It has. But you know, you have communities that build, like, say, 50 units, and they'll put five affordable housing units in there, and everybody will jump up and down saying, hey, we have five more affordable housing units. And that's not enough. It's not enough. And, again, the burden falls on the cities to do this. So, you know, I don't want to get into Westport or, you know, any particular town specifically, but I'm just saying that the burden of affordable housing falls on the cities, and every community has an obligation to build housing for its people, for our citizens of it, of the state. So whether it's around, and a lot of right now, a lot of people like transit-oriented development around there. But you could still build housing on smaller pieces of property, smaller parcels. You could build duplexes. You could build some small condos. You could build, you know, apartment building, whatever. I'm not saying what a town should build, but I'm just saying that there needs to be a thought process of more diverse housing stock. And again, for kids who are getting out of college, for people who are trying to start families, for senior citizens who want to downsize and still live in their communities, this is not rocket science. And these communities need to take some initiative and build some. Actually, we'll say New Canaan has been doing a pretty good job of building affordable housing. That's one community I will say has been doing a good job.
Thank you.
Okay. One other thing I want to say. Can I say one more thing?
Very quickly, Anthony. We're running out of time. Bob, Go ahead, please.
Okay, Bob, thank you for all the years with Ina when we started, that you came to all the meetings and helped everyone, and you never missed one that we had, and you cared at that time, and I do appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
I appreciate
State
that
Senator.
Very much. Thank you. And good luck
thank
in Westport.
Thank you, State Senator Bob Duff. Good luck in November. Our majority leader, Democrat, running as an incumbent for a state Senate district that represents Norwalk and also part of Darien. Thank you so much for joining us today. The next guest is Jeffrey Wright. Jeffrey has been very active as a Republican, and he has led a lot of Republican campaigns. He's been very active in Republican RTCs throughout our state. But he called me up last week, not having anything to do with politics, having something to do with his just being a concerned citizen, frankly, an irate citizen, about the merger of M&T and People's Bank and all of the impossible kind of situations that many depositors found themselves in, including when you were a fiduciary. I have a lot of friends that are conservators and fiduciaries, and they were not able to get money to the people who were entitled to that money in time. And sometimes in cases they were accused of having absconded with money when they did no such thing. It's just that the entire merger has been such a debacle. Kevin Rennie writing an extensive column this morning in the Hartford Courant about the quote-unquote fiasco. And as we know, Senator Blumenthal, as well as Attorney General William Tong, saying that they're going to initiate an investigation. But Mr. Wright wanted to come on himself and talk about what he knew about this and what his speculations are about the why and the when of all of this. Jeffrey Wright, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Good morning.
Glad to be on, Lisa.
Thank you. So I know that you've been very passionate. Why does this story, or why does this merger, why is this really getting at your goat, Jeffrey?
Well, I think, and you'd mentioned the fiduciary aspect. This is not a merger or an acquisition of a hamburger joint. This is not McDonald's buying Burger King. This is banking. This is people's, most people's, and I would actually proffer that everyone, Republican, Democrat, regardless of old, young, anything, any diversion within our society could possibly think of, the one unifying force is everyone's concern and management access to their hard-earned money. And is where M&T has completely, 100% failed. If you were not an account holder during this transition, you may have heard that there were some bumps and bruises here and there to be expected. But had you been an account owner, or had you been a politician, or had you been somebody that had heard this, and if you had gone into the branches, you would have seen abject chaos. The people working within the branches, which are to my knowledge and from what I have seen, are past and current people's employees. And believe me, you, they were taking grenades nonstop. At 8:45, just about every morning, take your pick on the branch, there were people waiting in line, and they were pouring in. Not necessarily to conduct transactions, but because they could not conduct transactions.
So what do you
None
think?
None of these issues could be solved in the branch. You were given access to a video to handle it at home. In the past, I've dealt with numerous banks and investment outfits. Everything was generally straightened out there. But for whatever reason, under the new format, it cannot. And it has been chaos. But more importantly, their systems integration was so failed that even their own process of setting up different passwords was fault. Mm. And I found a couple of the embedded faults, and I communicated that with friends of mine at the bank, where it was, unless you knew where the fault was, it was impossible to proceed forward. And that's a failure of integration. It's a failure of system integration. And if you had 13 months to do this, to dry test it, to reverse engineer it, as most people do in their job, I certainly do in mine, you would have found the faults. But clearly, they did not. And the French have a term for this. It's incompetent. In other words, incompetent. Or it is willful neglect. Either way, it's not a good look.
Yeah, we're chatting with Jeffrey Ryan. I'll tell you what concerns me. When I this has always been my concern, and I was astonished when I announced it before the merger. I told my audience and I told myself, you know, you've got to print out all of your statements because they're not going to be available online. And even as I was saying that, Jeffrey, I was shocked. And I thought, how could they do that? But I, like so many others, I didn't get to do it. I didn't get to print out all my statements. I'm still on my extension from 2021. So 2022 did not get printed.
A habitual extension filer. And traditionally, Peoples, as with A.G. Edwards and Merrill Lynch and every other financial Bank of America, they hold your accounts, your statements. And that was the trade. If you didn't want to receive, if you wanted to help the environment, you did not take paper statements. And it will always be accessible on a PDF form. That's a good trade, and I willingly signed up to it. I'm concerned about the environment as much as everyone else is. No, I did not get the messaging as far as you needed to download the access. But even if I did, and even if I had done that, who's to say the computer melts out? You lose your hard drive. There's a flood. There's a myriad of things that could have happened. One would think that that would be a fundamental basic access point. And to that point, caveat here, when all this was blowing up left and right, I bypassed the traditional complaint forms, and I sent a relatively straightforward email that was addressed to three people. It was addressed to Reese Jones, who's the current chairman of MBT. It was addressed to the attorney general, and it was addressed to the past chairman, which apparently all people's emails were literally cut off in the transition. So I know he did not, that individual, that's John Barnes, I believe, did not get it. And I lit him up. And within 2-3 days, I have to congratulate the attorney general, stepped in with his statement. And after that, I received a call from the president's office, and I vented my concerns. And within a week, I did receive my statements without the checks, so that had to be rectified. But the concerning part, I kid you not, I have 10 accounts with Peoples now, M&T, three of them business. The statements, literally, someone in a basement photocopied the statements and turned them into three gigantic PDFs.
You're kidding me.
It's just one PDF with 500 plus pages.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's literally photocopied. So I'm now concerned for the future, for those that wish to access their accounts. My father is a man of a certain age, and I happen to be attending a high school reunion. And I now have a meeting with his trust attorney. And, yes, we are going to be moving those accounts, as I am mine.
You are going to move. You're going to move them, huh? You're going to get out. Yeah.
And I'm going to get to why.
Tell me.
Besides everything that's obvious. But within the statements, one would think on an $8.3 billion acquisition, you could sequester the resources and the funds to maintain the existing people's structure of access, easy access to people's the account holders' statements. Make it easy. Don't make it hard.
So, Jeffrey Wright, let me just interrupt you for a minute.
Responsibility to
let me just
we
interrupt.
Talk about Jeffrey, disenfranchisement.
Yeah, Go let ahead. Me just tell you this. I have an email from a listener who's saying we're chatting about the merger between M&T and People's. Big article in the Hartford Courant. Jeffrey Wright, a very concerned citizen who wrote his own letter of complaint. I have an email from a listener who says, I still, capital still, cannot set up external transfers to other banks. The section of their website that deals with this doesn't work properly. Obviously, I could not reach anyone by phone. I have now stopped into my local branch and even worked with the branch manager. She could not get the system to work. She said she would be in touch with tech support at HQ. I am still waiting for resolution many days after my visits. Anne says, I have a HELOC with them, but I can't switch because it would require a lot of other problems. And it's, quote, horrible, H-O-R-R-I-B-L-E in caps. It's a mess, Jeffrey Wright. It's a mess.
Well, we can just go with Jeff for the current moment.
Jeffrey.
It is a disastrous mess. And it's, again, it's either incompetence or willful neglect. And as I indicated before, neither is an acceptable solution. I have relative no doubt that in the coming months, the access points to funding, et cetera, will more than likely be rectified. But I pose this. If a bank had this amount, if a financial institution had 13 months plus leeway to execute a proper transition, how confident are you that there will not be future problems? How confident is any account holder that this bank is not going to screw things up left and right? Are you comfortable leaving your money there? My answer in particular is no. I will be moving the money. And we, as small account owners, in the grand scheme of things, we can only vote. We can only make our decisions as we see fit. And I'm not advocating for anybody to do anything that they're uncomfortable with. But for my 35-year relationship with an institution that has been around to close to 200 years will cease because it was handled as if it was an acquisition of a burger chain. And I cannot tolerate that. And that's why it's moving. And that's the only option that we, the people, have.
Okay, Jeffrey. Thank you very much for calling in today. Thank you for your sentiments and continuing to bring attention to this topic. We're not going to let it go either. Senator Blumenthal is coming on in a couple of days to talk about it.
Well, I thank his office as well. It seems to be moving up the chain, and perhaps Elizabeth Warren, I believe she's on the Banking Commission, perhaps that's the next access point. I was suggested by numerous people, if you wish to file a complaint, apparently the best way to do it is through the New York State Department of Financial Services. I have it open in front of me. It says consumer complaint. So maybe you could look into that yourself and maybe disseminate that information to your vast listeners. And that way, everyone has a voice that needs that can be heard. Because if you listen to the statements from the banking officials, they are, in essence, indicating that the employees and perhaps the account owners, well, maybe they're kind of on the rubbish side, and maybe this is just an issue of those that are of a certain age. And I completely disagree with that. So go to the New York Financial Services website, lodge the complaint, and do what you can.
Okay. Thank you so much. Jeffrey Wright on the Lisa Wexler Show. Listen, I was reading about a group. It's called HelpSy, H-E-L-P-S-Y. That says it is a for-profit B corporation. We're going to learn about what that means. It's not a regular S corporation or a C corporation. It's called a B corporation. They're social utility for-profit companies. And this particular company describes itself as having an environmental mission to radically change the way we think about clothing recycling. Join us now is the Director of Municipal Relations for HelpSy. Her name is Lisa, I don't want to butcher this, Scannella? I'm not going to say it right. Scannella, Lisa. I know the Lisa part. I can say that correctly. Lisa, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show. Lisa, how do I pronounce your last name?
Thank you, Lisa. I'm glad to be here. It's Scannella. So you got Scannella. The first part, first name, totally right.
Thank you. Yeah, the first name I can hear. Do. That's good. Lisa,
yeah,
Lisa.
But thanks for having me. We're really excited to be able to talk about the problem that is textile waste. So how did you hear about us?
I heard about you because I must have read about you in an article about how successful Norwalk was in doing
yes.
this in April, and then you kept doing it, and you got thousands of pounds of clothing.
Yeah, so Norwalk, Connecticut is one of the municipalities that we work with. We've worked with over 20 municipalities so far. And I'll kind of step back a little bit and kind of explain. We are a certified B corporation, like you mentioned, which means that we are required to balance our profits with purpose. And our purpose is to radically change the way people think about dispose of, recycle, and buy secondhand clothing. And while doing this, we want to change the perception around secondhand clothing altogether and shed light on the problem that is textile waste.
And what is the problem of textile waste? Yeah, tell me. Okay,
exactly.
Go ahead.
How many pounds would you guess the average person discards of each year of clothing?
Pounds of clothing discards? I can think of hoarders who never discard anything. But if I'm discarding in terms of pounds and I wanted to be good about it, I would say maybe a suitcase full, which would be about 25 to 30 pounds.
I like the logic there. No, it's over 100 pounds per person per year, and 85% of it could have been reused or recycled. So it is a big problem. And of course, it kind of reduces the environmental burden of the clothing industry. There's a lot of like water and CO2 emissions involved with the production of new clothing. And if that new clothing ends up in the trash, you know, we're wasting all of our a lot of our environmental resources.
So let's talk a little bit about this. So textile waste is a huge thing. We're not talking about the textiles that are good enough to go back to consignment or Goodwill, and because a lot of us are in the habit of making sure that things that are in pretty good shape have a chance to be recycled in the obvious way. You're talking about something else.
We're talking about all of it.
So all of
we're
it.
Saying
okay.
According to the EPA, 100 pounds per person per year ends up in the trash, and that is including, so that 15% that doesn't end up in the trash is what you're talking about. It ends up in a Goodwill, it ends up in a clothing drive, it ends up in a bin, it could be resold at a thrift store. Some people take things to consignment. That all of that together is only accounting for like 15% of the textile waste problem.
Because a lot of the stuff like used underwear, it's used underwear. It's textile waste,
right.
But nobody can use it again. So,
sometimes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and it's like the norm in most homes to recycle plastics, glass, metals, and paper. But usually people don't think about recycling clothing and shoes. And it actually is about 6% of our landfills are
really?
Clothing and shoes. So a lot of the municipalities actually carry the costs of discarding those materials that could be used, which is a big problem. So when we partner with municipalities like Norwalk, we offer them textile recycling solutions. And that includes, like you said, use underwear. We also take stuffed animals, but we also take nicer items. We take the whole range, and that's something that sets us apart from other businesses in the industry, is that we take all kind of conditions, right? And our job is to extend what we can. So 75% of what we collect is reusable as is, as clothing. 20% is recyclable. So that might be, like you said, underwear or like a sock that doesn't have a pair or something that's damaged, it has a hole. It's not really desirable or used as clothing anymore. So what happens to the clothing we collect? Items are sorted by Helpsee and our partners, and then we're divided into grades. The higher grades are resold as clothing, either through our online platform and marketplace, or they're resold to resellers that actually make a living selling secondhand clothing. We're resold to the thrift store markets, and then the lower grades go to industrial use and are made into things like rags, stuffing, and insulation.
Oh, okay. Now, you're a for-profit, as you said, with a social utility, a purpose. So how do you make money on this? And I guess the money goes back into having employees and whatnot, but how do you make money?
Yeah, so we sell the clothing that we collect. We pay for all the clothing that we collect, especially when we work with charities, cities, organizations.
Oh.
So Norwalk, for example, we not only are saving them the tipping fees, which is how much they would pay for it to end up in a landfill, but we also pay them per pound of the clothing that we collect. And so this actually allows them to subsidize other trash and recycling efforts that they may have going on. Some of the municipalities we work with choose to channel those funds into the schools, or maybe they have like a charity that they kind of donate all those funds to. But that is basically how we work, is all the clothing that we have, that we collect, we sell and find like the best end use for it. So the higher grades, you know, we get sometimes really nice things that are new with tags, fill in boxes, and that, you know, reasonably somebody else would want to buy that item, and then the lower grades are sold much, much, much less and are recycled down to other commodities.
So when did you – we're talking about Help Scene. You can go on the website. I'm on it right now. I'm looking at your shoes. So your shoes are not, you know, that cheap. In other words, and it's no – how do I know that they're used or not used? Do I just have to go by the picture and to see – the level of usage of them? It's a little bit hard to tell.
Yeah, so if you go on healthsay.com, you can check the condition. So it'll say pre-loved. It'll say new with tags if it is new with tags. But otherwise, if it does not say new with tags, you know, everything is secondhand.
Secondhand. And the price range is a lot of them are around $38. Some of them are $50. There's one I saw at $87. But it's not $10, at least for your newest arrivals. So, I mean, then the shoes look very good quality. Don't get me wrong. But so that's interesting, too. So you're not like a bargain basement site, Helpsee. It's not like $5 and running away with things really, really cheap. That's not your aim.
No. So for Helpsee.com, which is the online platform, which is just one of the channels that we resell clothing, there are high quality items. So that is the cream of the crop of what we receive and what we collect. So the prices that you're seeing kind of reflect that.
Very cool.
And that's one of the ways that kind of we channel clothes. We also sell our clothing through Helpsee Source, which has a separate website than you're on. And that would be geared more towards like micro wholesale. So it might be selling back to resellers who then post things on Poshmark or eBay. It might be sourcing to a local thrift store that has trouble, you know, stocking. Let's say they want pieces of Banana Republic because that sells really well. So they'll buy a box, a mystery box, so to speak, of, you know, 500 pieces of Banana Republic or whatever the case may be.
I see.
That's another way that we sell clothing.
So this is really cool. So I just approach this from the point of view of a consumer buying. But the truth is, what you're trying to tell us is that every year people are cleaning out their closets, or you're cleaning out the closet of someone else. You're helping out a friend, a loved one. Maybe somebody has passed away. You have to clean out someone's closet. Sometimes it's not a happy thing to do, but it has to be done. So would we call Helpsee, or would we have to call our local town to see if Helpsee has a program with the town?
So there's a couple of ways that you can work with us. Definitely call your local town, tell them that you want to partner with us, and we'll get something going. It is a revenue-generating contract for all the municipalities. There's absolutely no cost associated with the municipality working with us. And with the municipality partnership, we provide the home pickup. So you'll, as a resident, you'll sign on our pickup website. It will be like a Norwalks is www.healthcity.co/NorwalkCP. You pick a date and a time, and we pick up your bag straight from your house.
You do.
We have a partnership with them already.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and then we also do, we try to make it as convenient as possible because we realize, you know, shifting that perception of like recycling textiles, just how is the norm with like glass and plastic, is going to take some time and some education. And the easier you can make it for people, the more likely that it will be successful. And that's important to us. So we do pick up from people's houses. And so we set up those contracts and we kind of work around trash and recycling schedules. So we're not conflicting with anything going on there. We also do clothing drives. And that would be, we can do that in partnership with any organization or an individual. So we have some nonprofit partners. In Connecticut, we work with Big Brothers Big Sisters. So anyone who's interested in hosting a clothing drive to benefit Big Brothers Big Sisters, we're happy to set that up. All we need is a place to park the truck, a date and a time. We'll even provide marketing support. And then instead of, you know, making a monetary donation to Big Brothers Big Sisters, you bring all your youth clothes and textiles, and they will get a benefit from that.
Lisa, how long? We're chatting with Lisa Chanella of Helpsee, H-E-L-P-S-Y. Which is a company that was formed with a social purpose. And the social purpose is to try and diminish textile waste via recycling items. And I guess what I'm asking you is, the social utility of this is that you're keeping clothing back on people's backs without putting it in landfill, right? That's the social utility of this? Is that the point, that these items can continue to be used?
Yeah, the items can be continued to reuse, and then we are saving millions of pounds of CO2 and billions of gallons of water Last year alone, we paid more than $400,000 to charities and municipalities for clothing that we collected. So there's also social impact there. And this year, this winter, actually, we're starting a new initiative and part of our sorting process to pull out usable coats. And we're actually donating those. Donating those to the communities that we work with. So that's a new program that we're piloting this year. We're really excited about it because as, you know, the fall comes closer, people are in need of coats. So if there's any mission-driven thrift stores or churches that could use some coats, we're happy to talk to you about that as well.
So Lisa, I guess what I'm asking you, I'm curious about this. Are you big enough yet that you pose any kind of a threat to all the new manufacturing of clothing out there? In other words, do you envision a world where there are less new items of clothing being manufactured? Is that sort of an ultimate goal?
I think ultimately, yes. Ultimately, that would be fantastic. And how can we work with the fashion industry long-term as a reverse logistics partner for all the returns? That's a problem that they have, especially with e-commerce on the rise. There are lots of opportunities there, right? So long-term, that's absolutely our goal, is how can we reduce the environmental impact that the fashion industry has? And how we're doing it now is by, you know, pushing the secondhand clothing. And there's so much clothing that can be reused. Maybe we don't need to make as much.
We're chatting with Lisa Chanella. That's what I was trying to get to. So in other words, in your perfect world, when I go to Bloomingdale's, there's the new clothing and there's your clothing.
That'd be fantastic.
Right?
Yes, in a perfect world. Yes.
Right. So that people who want to spend their dollars in a way that you think has more social utility because they're using the same wool from the same sheep again and again, they have an opportunity to do so. Mm-hmm. I get
it. Yeah, and I think people are generally becoming more environmentally conscious. So mm-hmm. we definitely want to hope that continues. I mean, it has to, based on, the impact that we as humans are having on the earth and the environment. We need to do something about it.
Well, I will tell you, Lisa, in my own small way, and this is not for any social utility grander purpose, but I never give up a shoe that fits. So if my if my shoe fits, I will have a shoe man, and it is usually a man. I don't think I've ever had a woman shoe repair woman, but hopefully one day will. But anyway, my shoe repairman will see me again and again and again, season after season, to keep my shoe alive. Taps and soles and resoles and re-insoles and re-heels. I don't care what it is. I keep my shoes alive. And that's something as
I've
aged.
And I think that's the mindset that we need to have, is we don't want to just, I don't want this shirt. I don't want to drive somewhere to put it. I'm just going to throw it in the trash. Or, if it's something that can be reused, that's ultimately the best way to recycle is, it's reuse, reduce, recycle. Reusing is the highest form that we can kind of save our resources. So thank you for fixing your shoes.
Yeah, I fixed my shoes, but sometimes I can't get the stain out of the silk blouse. And when I can't get the stain out of the silk blouse, it has to go into the trash. There's literally nothing I can do about it. So maybe you can do something with that silk blouse. Maybe you can cut it up and reuse it. I can't get the stains out half the time.
Yeah, anyway, we take everything. Yeah. So we would be able to help you with your silk blouses. And hopefully you keep your shoes for a long time.
Thank you. Lisa Chanella, the Director of Municipal Relations at HelpSee. You can look them up online. You can find out about them whether you want to donate or buy. HELPSY. This is a socially responsible company, a B corporation, if you've never heard of these. These are relatively new companies that are around that say, you know what, we're not for profit. We want to make money, but we want to make money doing something that has a societally good benefit. And that's why they have that special designation. Lisa, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Lisa.